The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 20th of November 2020 on Monocle 24. The Briefing is brought to you in association with Novartis. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up on today's programme, we'll speak to the UN's Under-Secretary General for Humanitarian Affairs about the growing refugee crisis along Ethiopia's border with Sudan as the fighting in Tigray continues.
We are able to talk all the time to the authorities, but we haven't yet been able to secure the kind of access we think it would be in everybody's interest for humanitarian agencies to have into the north of the country.
Later in the show, we'll find out why Libya's government has had to warn Libya's political parties that next year's elections will go ahead with or without them. We'll round up the latest business news and we'll have our weekly reflection on the extent to which the last 7 days have left us any the wiser. That's all coming up right here on The Briefing on Monocle 24. And welcome to today's edition of The Briefing with me, Andrew Muller. After 2 weeks of war between Ethiopia and its region of Tigray, details about the fighting are hard to come by, thanks to a near-total disconnection of communications. However, what is understood is deeply disheartening, the more so because of the means by which the news is being relayed, from the gathering thousands of refugees fleeing Tigray and seeking shelter on the other side of its border with Sudan. As Ethiopia claims that its forces are closing on the Tigray capital, Mekelle, that exodus seems certain to accelerate. Well, earlier I spoke to Sir Mark Lowcock, United Nations Under-Secretary General for Humanitarian Affairs and Emergency Relief Coordinator. I began by asking what he's able to know for certain about what is happening in Tigray.
Well, I hope you won't mind if I make a broader point first, and then I'll come on to that.
Sure.
You know, I was first in this part of northern Ethiopia 35 years ago in the wake of the famine in which a million people lost their lives. And there's been a remarkable thing happen in that part of Ethiopia and more broadly over the last 35 years with huge development and progress in people's lives. Kids go to school now, they have health services, there are roads, there are power stations, there are factories. So the thing that is tragic about what's happening now is the danger that all that could be put at risk. Obviously, Ethiopia has a federal constitution, and what's at stake is the relative roles of the central government in Addis Ababa versus the regional governments. And it's disagreement over that, essentially, which has led to the current situation. Now, we do not have very good information or access. I have about 100 colleagues in the UN who are still in Tigray. Their freedom of movement is restricted, but there are a lot of limits to what we know. We are reliant on information made available by the various parties, which you obviously have to recognize the source of that information. We're obviously hearing lots of stories from people who are leaving Tigray. There's some heartrending stories of loss of life and suffering and so on that people reaching Sudan are telling us. We do know that there's a shortage of food and medicines and water increasingly because the electricity grid, which pumps water around the towns, isn't working anymore. So, you know, it is a situation we're extremely concerned about.
I'll come to those refugee exflows shortly, but are you able at the moment to have any kind of conversation with the authorities in Addis Ababa at all?
Yes, we have a lot of things we do all over Ethiopia, and we have excellent relations with government at every level. So we talk every day to the authorities in Addis Ababa. But the main thing in respect of Tigray we're asking for at the moment is just better access, because they were pressing 1 million people in Tigray who we were giving help to before the current problems. We were helping, among other things, deal with a huge locust outbreak in the east of Tigray, covering 50,000 hectares of potentially productive agricultural land. But a lot of the things we were doing have been paused, and we've had to stop doing them because of the current situation. And we are able to talk all the time to the authorities, but we haven't yet been able to secure the kind of access we think it would be in everybody's interest for humanitarian agencies to have into the north of the country.
To come back to those refugee exflows, which, as you were saying, are among the better sources of information anybody currently has about what's going on in Tigray, but is it possible to put a figure on how many people we're talking about and possibly how many more we're expecting over coming days and weeks?
Well, so far there's a bit more than 30,000 people who we as the UN have registered crossing from Ethiopia into Sudan, mostly across four crossing points. There are thousands arriving every day. Now, you can compare that, for example, with the population of Tigray, which is 5 or 6 million. Tigray also, though, was already home to displaced people and other refugees. So there's a huge mixture of people in this, quite large area. It borders places with lots of their own problems, obviously. Close to Somalia, bordering Eritrea. There are other security conflict problems in and around that part of Ethiopia. So notwithstanding the huge progress that has been made developmentally compared with the mid-1980s when I was first going there, it is a place where there's still a lot of fragility.
For all those reasons you outlined, this would obviously be quite a problem even at the best of times. When you're dealing with a situation like this amidst a global pandemic, how much more difficult does that make doing what you have to do?
Well, it obviously makes it a lot more difficult. That's a point made today by my colleague, Dr. Tedros, who's obviously Ethiopian himself and runs the World Health Organization. And one of the points he makes is, you know, there are dangers to everybody's health, which are reinforced by the current fighting. But I wouldn't say that COVID-19 is the biggest problem we have in this region. There's a whole set of ongoing humanitarian problems, many of which have got worse by the economic contraction caused by the virus and the pandemic. So it's the increase in food insecurity, the spread of measles and diphtheria and other preventable diseases, which are taking a lot more lives than the coronavirus is taking at the moment.
Is it your sense, though, that creating those refugee exflows is part of Ethiopia's strategy, that this is a deliberate design on their part?
Well, I hope that's not the case. I think Ethiopia has very good experience from its own history and its own generosity in hosting refugees of the burden that can be placed on countries having to accept a huge influx of people. In all my previous discussions with the authorities in Ethiopia, when it comes to problems in neighboring countries, for example, they have always emphasized the importance of peace and stability and resolving problems through dialogue, in order, not least, to minimize the additional burdens put on neighboring countries. And we would hope, and our dialogue with them is intended to have the same set of considerations apply in the current circumstances in northern Ethiopia.
Are you soliciting help from other countries in the vicinity aside from just Sudan as well?
We're in dialogue with all the neighboring countries, and I think what they would all like is a rapid, preferably peaceful resolution to this problem, because they've all got lots of other challenges. Ethiopia has, over recent decades, played a role as a bulwark of stability, really, across the Horn of Africa region. They've contributed, for example, generously to peacekeeping operations in South Sudan and Somalia. The current circumstances put some of Ethiopia's wider role in the region at risk as well, and that's not something the neighbours want to, not an additional set of problems the neighbours want to have to deal with.
What's your sense, though, of what appeals anybody's able to make to the authorities in Addis Ababa to, at the very least, de-escalate their operations in Tigray?
Well, there's an ongoing dialogue, and I think everybody is essentially trying to say the same sorts of things. Ultimately, you know, this is something that is going to be determined primarily by Ethiopians themselves, by the Tigray authorities, and then by the federal government. So everybody else can encourage and support and advise, but ultimately Ethiopians themselves will be in charge of their own destiny in this, in what's happening now.
The dreadful irony at the heart of this, of course, is that Abiy Ahmed, Ethiopia's prime minister, is an extremely recent recipient of the Nobel Prize for Peace. Does the fact of him being a Nobel Peace laureate make this any easier or harder to deal with? Is the fact of him having that prize leverage in any direction?
I'm not sure about that, really. I mean, I think the Prime Minister of Ethiopia inherited some very significant challenges. Ethiopia is a country of many nations, many different ethnic groups. And one of the things that tends to happen if you look through history, when more of people's basic needs get met, increasingly they wish for more freedoms, and particularly freedoms of expression and other ways to enhance their lives. I mean, Alexis de Tocqueville in the late 18th century wrote about that, of course, in France and in the US as well. And managing that process of accompanying economic development and material progress and access to better services with wider freedoms that human beings tend to want alongside those things is very, very challenging, particularly in a nation as ethnically, geographically, and in other ways, diverse as Ethiopia is.
Just as a final thought then, if things continue as they presently are, if there isn't a de-escalation or some sort of ceasefire or any other kind of abatement in the fighting, where could we be with this a few weeks or a month from now? How much worse could this get?
I think it is relevant to remember the recent history. I think the thing everybody needs to keep in their minds is the enormous gains and progress and improvement in the lives of Ethiopians over the last 30 years and the importance of securing that. Conflicts tend to involve lots of very bad behavior by one set of people against other sets of people. And that creates grievances and other issues which are long lasting. So everybody, I think, needs to take a deep breath and find a way to resolve the current disagreements around a table rather than at either end of a barrel of a gun.
That was Sir Mark Lowcock, United Nations Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs, speaking to me earlier. You're listening to The Briefing. Here's Monocle's Yolin Goffan with the day's other headlines.
Thanks, Andrew. U.S. President-elect Joe Biden's victory in Georgia has been confirmed by a recount. It came as attempts by Donald Trump's allies to challenge his defeat were dismissed in three states. Biden beat his Republican rival in Georgia by more than 12,000 votes. The World Health Organization has warned that Europe faces a tough 6 months. The WHO's Europe director, Hans Kluge, says the continent recorded more than 29,000 new COVID-19 deaths last week, but stressed lockdowns are reducing the number of new cases. Two Thai high school student leaders are to be charged with joining a banned protest. It comes a day after the country's government threatened tougher action against the demonstrators. The students say they have been summoned for violating an emergency decree. And today's Monocle Minute reports on Culver City's new 740 square meter citizen public market, which opened its doors this week. The market is a casual, community-minded affair that offers three outdoor dining options. You can find out more about it at monocle.com/minute. Those are today's headlines. Back to you, Andrew.
Thank you, Yolain. Libya was supposed to have held a general election 2 Decembers ago. It has been, like most other signifiers of progress in Libya, postponed. The tentatively good news is that it has now been rescheduled for next December. This long run-up theoretically gives all concerned plenty of time to organise themselves ahead of polls opening, but practically it might also give Libya's plentiful wreckers and obstructors time to stop them doing so. Libya's government has now sought to resolve this conundrum by issuing the extraordinary statement that the elections will definitely go ahead whether Libya's parties want them, agree to them, participate in them or not. Well, I'm joined with more on this by the Libya researcher Mary Fitzgerald. Mary, who was this statement aimed at?
Well, first of all, the statement was the outcome of the Libyan Political Dialogue Forum, which is a series of discussions that have been taking place over the last week or so before that discussions happening virtually, comprising 75 participants drawn from across Libya, various tribal notables, politicians, civil society representatives, etc. And they produced a statement. They've gone into recess for a week now and will resume their discussions after that. But they produced a statement that included this roadmap, if you like, which includes the plan for elections to be held on the 24th of December next year. Now, there are a lot of questions about this in terms of the statement refers to the fact that these will be presidential and parliamentary elections in accordance with the constitutional process. The only problem with that is that Libya doesn't actually have a constitution right now. We've had a process of drafting a constitution, but that constitution has not been put to a referendum, which it's required to do to become law. So a lot of questions about that. The roadmap itself is basically aiming to project a framework for the next year or so ahead of elections. Another hiccup, though, in that process is the fact that the dialogue forum, which has now, as I said, gone into recess, it went into recess without actually being able to agree on a new unity government to tide Libya over the next year or so. You know, a day is a long time in Libyan politics. So a lot of people are talking about what might happen within the next year in the run-up to possible elections if we don't have a constitutional framework in place, and also if we still have the spoilers that remain on the scene, of whom there are several, but one particular spoiler, Khalifa Haftar, the military commander based in eastern Libya, who spent over a year trying to capture the capital Tripoli from the UN-recognized government and failed. He has representatives taking part in a parallel track to this political process, which is the military track. But there are all kinds of questions regarding Haftar's actual commitment to this particular process right now, and whether he will at one point or another try to disrupt it as he's disrupted previous processes.
I mean, is there at least cause for more immediate optimism in the shape of the ceasefire that was agreed in Geneva in late October? Is that holding up okay?
It is, and some of Haftar's representatives were obviously involved in signing that. There have been follow-up meetings after that Geneva meeting. The key to understanding what's going on right now is to understand that that military track, that the other political track, and a further economic track are all happening in tandem. They all have to fit into each other eventually if the entire process is to work. So the military track cannot succeed or exist in isolation, nor can the political track and the economic track. So that's the Libyan puzzle, if you like. It has those three facets. They all have to come together in one for this to work and for Libya to move forward.
I mean, of the agreements that we are seeing, how much of them are organic agreements between actual Libyans, and to what extent are the various outside players enmeshed in Libya now steering this?
Well, the political dialogue process is presented as a Libyan-Libyan dialogue, as people refer to it. But it has been midwifed by the UN at the UN mission in Libya. The UN has also played a role in terms of midwifing the military track and the ceasefire that came out of that and was announced in Geneva last month. Similarly, there is an oversight, if you like, of the economic track. The meddlers in Libya, the foreign meddlers in Libya, of which there are many, but primarily at this current moment, the two key players are Turkey and Russia. Turkey, because it intervened on the part of the internationally recognized government last year in an attempt to counter Haftar's offensive on Tripoli. Russia, because Russia has been supporting Haftar for a number of years now and increased that support during his offensive on Tripoli. So what that Haftar's war in Tripoli resulted in was Turkey and Russia becoming the two key external players. They obviously back rival sides, but there are signs that Turkey and Russia may be prepared to work together on Libya. And one of the worries within the UN is that the current UN backed process aimed at finding a resolution to the conflict and coming up with a political settlement may be overshadowed or undermined by a Turkey-Russia process that could yet emerge.
Mary Fitzgerald, thank you as always for joining us. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24.
Novartis is proud to partner The Briefing on Monocle 24. Novartis is a company that is committed to reimagining medicine. The global healthcare leader intent on changing the practice of medicine, Novartis has been exploring uncharted frontiers in science for more than a century. Today, the company is working on breakthrough treatments that push the boundaries of human understanding in biology, data science, and engineering to develop and deliver therapies that help people live longer and healthier lives around the world. Novartis, reimagining medicine.
You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. I'm Andrew Muller. Let's get the latest business headlines now with Ewan Potts from Bloomberg. Ewan, first of all, good news for persons who own shares in Tesla.
Andrew, on the 21st of December, Tesla becomes the biggest company ever to be added to the S&P 500 index. It's so big, it will be one of the 10 most valuable companies on the benchmark US index. Goldman Sachs today says that could create an extra $8 billion of demand from active US mutual funds. We already know that passive index trackers will be forced to buy the company when it is included on the index. The company is already the best performing large company in the US this year. It's up about 500% so far. Not a bad return on your money. And just to give you an idea of just how big it is, Nestle is the most valuable company in Europe. That's worth $330 billion. Tesla is worth $470 billion. So almost 50% bigger than Nestle. This is all in the company, which has only just started to turn a profit.
And also good news for people who during lockdown and anticipating the imminent collapse of civilization have piled into soya beans.
Yeah. Interesting story, Andrew, on the Bloomberg website from the province of Cordoba in Argentina, the country, a very big producer of soybeans, but a big problem with thefts or thieves, rather, in farms. So soybeans are harvested and kept in enormous sausage shaped polythene containers in Argentina with the contents worth up to $100,000 a piece. But vandals have been sneaking onto farms and taking knives to the bags, exposing the contents to moisture and rendering them worthless. Now, a couple of theories as to why this has been going on. There's growing tension between the leftist government in Buenos Aires and rich farmers in the countryside. Some say it's pro-government zealots trying to scare the farmers into exporting their soybeans and rather than holding onto them as a hedge against inflation and Argentinians' tumbling currency. Other than that, strong Chinese demand has meant very buoyant prices for farmers this year. But tackling those thieves is proving altogether more difficult.
And the police can't catch them because they keep doing a runner. Ewan Potts, thank you as always. That was Ewan Potts at Bloomberg. You are listening to The Briefing.
Keen for a quick tutorial on where you should take your business over the coming months?
These big long-term trends make it so that we can touch every country, and we have opportunities everywhere.
Interested to learn how one of the world's biggest pharma companies responded to the pandemic?
We were able to make really far-reaching communications to enable patients to get information that they needed.
Curious about the future of air travel?
Everybody's looking forward to connect with the world, connect with friends around the world, and just spend some leisure time and some relaxing time abroad.
Or wondering whether shops will still matter.
There's thousands of different journeys through the store that anyone who walks in could take.
Join me, Tyler Brulé, weekly when I sit down with the chiefs. From CEOs to editors-in-chief, CMOs to chief strategy officers, our series is a fast-paced, intimate discussion with chiefs, big and small, from around the world. That's The Chiefs, right here on Monocle 24, or wherever you find finer podcasts.
You're listening to The Briefing with me, Andrew Muller. It's time now for our weekly reflection on the degree to which the sum of human knowledge has been enriched by the last 7 days. This was recorded prior to Rudy Giuliani's most recent rhetorical, psychological, logical, spiritual, and literal meltdown, but it's not like he hadn't already given us plenty to work with. We learned this week that it's still funny to us, at least, to play the Four Seasons under any and every mention of Rudy Giuliani, personal attorney to US President Benito Cartman, and a lawyer who would defend you on a burglary charge by suggesting you appear in court wearing a mask and hooped shirt, toting a big bag with swag written on it, and plead not guilty on the basis that you only took all that stuff because you really wanted it. If any listeners require a catch-up, give yourself a couple of minutes to look up Four Seasons Total Landscaping of Philadelphia, and then, if our experience is any guide, give yourselves a solid 3 weeks to intermittently convulse with laughter every time you think of it. We learned that Rudy Giuliani may be a little out of practice at the whole appearing in front of actual judges as opposed to television audiences of credulous yokels thing. His first appearance before a federal beak in some decades did not go well, although his recent record considered, it was something that Giuliani did in fact turn up at the actual court in Williamsport as opposed to a food court or a tennis court. We learned as a consequence from the attorney representing the Allegheny County Board of Elections at the hearing into non-existent voter fraud that facing down Giuliani at this point in his career is a somewhat bemusing experience.
I sat there dumbfounded because the story that was presented by Mr. Giuliani bore no relationship to the actual complaint in the case. And, you know, when you're in court, you have to talk about the complaint. You have to talk about your facts. You have to talk about the law. When you're at Four Seasons Total Landscaping, I guess you can talk about anything.
We learned, indeed, from an equally unimpressed review from Pennsylvania's actual Attorney General that a new definition of middle age may be ability to recall Rudy Giuliani being a widely admired and respected public figure, known for responding to calamitous crisis with poise and compassion, as opposed to a frothing rodeo clown shilling hysterically for a lunatic.
You know, it's sad. It's sad to watch someone who America looked to at a time of need descend into this type of lunacy and conspiracy theory and fear mongering in a way that's not helping this country in any way. And is again, speaking to really an audience of one. I see a man who is sad. I see a man who clearly forgot what he learned in law school. And I see a man who's got absolutely no evidence to back up the ridiculous claims that his client makes on Twitter every day.
Picky, picky, picky. We continued to learn, however, that in the special electoral college in Donald Trump's head, the president remains on track for victory. Indeed, we learned from Kayleigh McEnany, Trump's press secretary and 23rd place getter on 2022's series of The Masked Singer, that Trump anticipates re-election to the extent of planning to attend his own inauguration at the Capitol on January 20th.
It would look pretty bad if he did not attend the inauguration. It would sound like, well, look like sour grapes, wouldn't it?
I think the president will attend his own inauguration. He would have to be there, in fact.
Although, if Giuliani is organizing it, this could be quite an occasion for Capitol Dry Cleaners of Dayton, Ohio. A real business, which we took the time to look up because we know our listeners expect that kind of attention to detail. It's on Shiloh Springs Road, next to an insurance company and the fireworks shop. Despite Donald Trump's ongoing best efforts, we did learn, however, that not every American prima donna of a certain age with dubiously authentic hair and a fondness for applying makeup with a trowel is necessarily a malevolent influence.
If teardrops were pennies and heartaches were gold.
A less discerning, whimsical news monologue would be playing this item in with 9 to 5 or Jolene, but we've always had a soft spot for Dolly Parton's duets with Porter Wagoner, so that's what you're getting. For we learned that if one American vaccine turns out to be what frees us from COVID-19, we will owe a debt to Dolly Parton, $1 million to be precise, which was the amount she kicked in a while back to Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Nashville, which is a trial site for the Moderna jab. We also learned, after scouring Parton's catalogue in search of a song title we could leverage some desperate vaccine-related pun off, that the pickings on this front are disappointingly slender. You can yelp the word vaccine over Jolene, but we felt it beneath us.
Yeah.
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 Mm-hmm.
And in the animal kingdom, winged department, we also learned of the bewildering high prices that can be commanded in certain rarefied quarters by creatures usually regarded as annoying airborne vermin. A Chinese purchaser received startlingly little change from $2 million for a racing pigeon purchased at auction from a breeder in Belgium. The record price was earned by a pigeon hen called New Kim. And we learned that this item tied up this week's What We Learned monologue quite nicely with a neat going out where we came in device, as New Kim does in fact have something in common with Rudy Giuliani.
Didn't he do this gag a few weeks ago? Christ almighty.
Yes, it's not the only one attempting a coup. Get enough of that at home. That's all for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Rhys James and Yolin Goffan. Our studio manager was Maylee Evans. The Briefing returns on Monday at the same time. That's 1300 in Berlin, 7 a.m. in New York City. I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Have a terrific weekend.